Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, June 14th, 2012. A few topics tonight before the main science topic. The main science topic tonight will be talking about the earthquake events that happened as reported during the Moses event. And as you know, I've been going into detail recently talking about the events of ancient history. Here's what's happened. The churches don't teach this. They want you to feel good when you leave church. It's the touchy-feely, everybody feel good, shake hands with your neighbor, everything's swell, and don't forget to drop some money in the collection box. That's pretty much what you get in churches today. So, but they don't talk about reality. They don't talk about history. It's simply been lost. This is supported by standard science, which simply says nothing has happened on a catastrophic basis and denies any of these events could have possibly happened. So the public is left. They leave from the two main education centers, I would say, for most adults, church and the news media, or the standard science saying nothing happened. And as a result, the main, most important events in the history of modern man have simply denied. They're like treated like fairy tales. So what I've been doing is going back into these events and putting some truth to them, talking about the physics of these events. So tonight I will be talking about the Moses event, and if I get a chance, if there's enough time, I will also start talking about things like the burning bush. Those will certainly be in upcoming shows if I don't get to it on this show. But first, a couple of announcements. This past week, for all of you people who think the political system out there is going to save you, well, I've got news for you. This week, and I think I think it's actually good. I think it's a wake-up call. A guy named Ron Paul, and I had mentioned many times on my show that he was a great candidate. I particularly don't like voting. Local issues, yeah, you know, a lot of local issues actually are voted on, in particular, you say, cost measures or whatever. But you get up to the national level, and we have a one-party system here. It's the Republicans and the Democrats are exactly the same. I saw a great YouTube video that showed Obama talking about his platform and Romney talking about his platform, and they repeated one after the other on various topics, and they said exactly the same thing. But the only difference is whose buddies get the money for 4 years. And that's going on. I hear rumblings amongst Republicans, well, like, we really got to get Obama out of there because the money has not been flowing our way. Well, it's, this dog and pony show has been going on for 100 years now, and every 4 years or every 8 years we have a change of regime, and so the money flow gets back into another sector, another group of buddies that go down the food chain, and those are the kind of the second and third level people in the pyramid. The very top pyramid, the aerospace industry, the military complex, all of those people, they always get their money, no matter who's in. But you go down to the next level down, the average businessman or the businessman who's developing or whatever, they are really in a flow of money that comes based on the political party. And so the Republicans have been out of the loop for the last 4 years. The Democrats have been in there taking all the money and stuffing it in their pockets. And so now the Republicans are hoping for a change of regime so that the money will flow down through their channels. But the end result, a guy named Ron Paul was running and sounded like he was going to actually change this country back to the capital-based country that it once was, where people had their own investment dollars. They didn't have to turn and borrow from the banks. Things were rolling in the economy prior to 1913. In fact, things were rolling so well that the banks didn't have any business. Nobody went into the bank. Maybe they held some money there, but the banks didn't have anything going on. So they went in and changed things around a little bit, so the money had to flow through the banks. They basically took the banking out of the federal, out of Congress is what they did. So, but anyway, Ron Paul was a guy who wanted to return to our original system of government and reduce the federal government. This past week, he dropped out of the race and he gave all his money to Romney. And, of course, Ron Paul never ran as an independent. He always ran as a Republican. And there's no way they're going to let somebody like that win. The story is that he won many of the primaries. In fact, he probably won it all. But the elections are so crooked and fixed that they're not going to let a guy like that in there. And Congress is bought and paid for. So the end result is for all those people who contributed to Ron Paul and Ron Paul this and Ron Paul that, he has now dumped all of his earnings and winnings, so to speak, or support, into mainstream Republican politics. And so for all those people out there who thought Ron Paul was going to save them, I think it's a good thing because it's maybe the final wake-up call for people, many people, to realize that the political system is not going to save you. You have to deal with yourself. And I know a lot of people who out there, they have deals, they have financial things, they have other progress they're trying to make, and it's very limited because of political, politics. That can't move forward or whatever because of politics. And the end result is that get out of the concept, get away from that concept that government is going to help you. Government is going to save you. Government is going to do something beneficial for you because ultimately it isn't going to happen. So you have to depend on yourself. But anyway, the issue that Ron Paul has dropped out and is now dumped all his money over to Romney, and all of these people had sent in money, it's really just, there's a lot of people that now really look at him as a traitor, a sellout. But for me, my view is that for a lot of these people, it's a wake-up call that the political system is not going to save you. Forget about the next election or the next election, whatever. No, you're going to get more of the same. Anyway, I don't want to politicize too much, but just remember that you have to take care of yourself. That's the bottom line. And get out of the way because this train wreck is on the way and there's nothing that's going to stop it. Okay, so that's for all those people that still live in fairy tale land out there. And just remember that for any person that votes out there who's normal, whether you're a Republican, Democrat, Independent, or whatever, there's two illegal voters for every one of you who are looking for a handout. And their only reason for voting is to try and get a handout or something like that. So anyway, enough of that. The spring solstice this coming week, the 21st, interestingly enough, coincides with the new moon. And does that mean there's going to be an alignment in the end of the world? No. We live in a celestial clock, and these cycles move around and move around, and eventually they're going to coincide. Certain things are going to coincide. Planetary alignments are going to coincide. So, and I talk about that in my weather book and the real effects. But the bottom line is that this week, very interesting spring solstice. And it's the spring solstice of 2012. Does that mean anything? No, it's another spring solstice. So the real issue here is that we live in a celestial clock. All of these movements are going on, and the ancients used it as a way of counting. And I just want you to remember that what people use today and call the Mayan calendar is really the Aztec calendar. There's so much misinformation out there, and no, the Mayan calendar does not predict the end of the world December 21st, 2012, and neither does anything else that I can make out myself. The Mayan calendar refers to the cycles of Venus. And so what people show as the Mayan calendar is the Aztec calendar, which was adopted from the Mayan calendar. It has 360 days, and they add in 5 days in there and a quarter to make it end up where it should be, because we have 365 and a quarter days in the year right now. So at any rate, the Mayan calendar does not have anything to do with the moon or the sun or the Gregorian calendar or anything like that. So once again, and I said this last week, I went into a little more detail because of the tremendous fanfare, the platform that this gives Standard Science, all the hoopla about 2012 and the Mayan calendar. It gives Standard Science the platform to come out and say, look at how ridiculous that is. Look at how smart the Standard Science people are. That's their, then they can sit there and laugh and guffaw at the how stupid the 2012 stuff is. But just remember, the 2012 stuff is all a contrived misinformation campaign in the first place. It's meant to fool the public, and they're going to do it. About 88 to 99% of the public are going to be fooled by this and accept the standard astronomy story of how they're smart and nothing has happened, and we live in a universe where the Earth has not had any major events for millions and millions of years, etc. So we're starting the hurricane season. It's beginning right about now and should last into November. But so far it's been rather quiet out there. And my prediction for this year also was that we should have a relatively quiet hurricane year. We don't have a lot of major electrical alignments in the solar system, but that could change based on current conditions. Those are long-term predictions based on planetary electrical alignments, not gravitational alignments, mind you, not based on the galactic plane or something else. No, these are based on my work dealing with the real causes of weather, the electrical causes of weather in the solar system. But this year we don't really have a lot, as with the last couple years, and so really we're not expecting a great deal of hurricane activity this year. There could be other causes if we get some major comets into the solar system. We're heading into the next solar cycle, so the fact that the sun is picking up in energy, if we get some localized flaring from the sun, some CME activity that comes out at just the right time, could cause some hurricane activity. But that, you can't predict that. That's the kind of thing that the sun is a very volatile heat engine, and so we'll have to wait and see. Those are very local events that come in. They get added in after the fact, so to speak. So those are things that we can't really predict. Just a quick financial announcement. I saw that this was an interesting announcement on a front page of a newspaper. It said that 39% of family wealth in the United States had been lost in the last 3 years. Well, gee, that's pretty interesting. For some people I know, they lost 100%. They lost their house, they lost everything they invested in. So if the average is 39%, and where do these people come up with this? The people who are homeless don't get added into these surveys because they're not around to answer the phone. So how do you survey the homeless people who are families, etc., have been put out on the street that lost 100% of everything, lost their jobs, lost their home. That's more than 100% because you've lost all your savings, things, all the investment people put into their homes. And I always look at it this way. They look in terms of financial loss. I look in terms of social loss, the families that have been destroyed, the tremendous agony these people are going through. And for what? A worthless dollar in a banking system that's based on error. There are no such things in a real economy as economic cycles. That's a myth. You look at countries like everybody laughs at Cuba. Cuba has had no economic cycles. They've had steady, very controlled growth. And now Cuba is one of the major factors in Latin America. They are one of the best educated publics. They have the best medicine per person. They have the best dental per person of any country, including way better than the United States. But, people criticize them because they don't have all of the highest tech medical equipment, etc. But they have good natural health. They have good food for everybody. Nobody goes hungry. There's no starvation in Cuba. You know, it's a poor country because they've had a blockade around them from economic growth by the United States for the last 50 years. But that is really, they're trading with Latin America. They will trade, for example, medical education from people from other countries for chickens or bananas or fruit or other goods and services. Or with Venezuela for oil, for example. And so there's a lot of value in what Cuba has. But that is not something that the banking community is interested in having you understand. That, look in the United States, 95% of the people don't have realistic health insurance. The 5% that do pay a boatload for it, and really they don't have that good a service either. A lot of people go to Canada. Retirees and older people are being squeezed out of the insurance business. They are having insurance. They just can't afford it. How can you afford a $500 or $1,000 a month insurance payment when you're getting $1,500 Social Security? You just have to stop doing it. You just have to stop getting it. So at any rate, I find it interesting. Iceland has, I got an email forwarded to me this week, and it said, what have you heard from Iceland in the news? Well, you don't hear anything from Iceland. All you hear about is the European bailout. Every country in Europe is going to need a bailout soon. You don't hear about Iceland. Iceland in, 2008? Throughout the banking community, the international banking community, their currency went to zero and their stock market crashed, but now they are heading on the route of Cuba. They are an independent country with their own monetary system, their own government, and there was never a shot fired, there was no violence. They simply threw out the government and took over and said, we will not pay this. We're not going to be slaves to international bankers. And they basically wrote off their international debt, said, we're not paying it. We're not paying our labors and our future labors of ourselves and our kids and our grandchildren to phony money that comes in from outside and has loaned with interest. And it's a trap. So like a caged animal, they had to fight back. And so they're now attempting to make a go of it there. And with the embargoes and the other subtle forms of economic pressure to force them back into this, Iceland is making a go of it. And they will probably outsurvive the United States. So at any rate, the second world, let's put it that way, a lot of people in the second world, not the third world, but the second world, the Irans, Cuba would very easily be put in the second world by what Westerners call if you look on other scales, you would find Cuba and Iceland in what you would call the first world. They're countries that are independent, they can start to trade, they can start to do business internationally, and there's a lot of countries in that growing number of people. When Obama went to Cartagena, Colombia this past a month or so ago, and basically he was shunned. Nobody would deal with him. Nobody would talk with him. And the United States was basically told that if Cuba is not in their meeting next year, there won't be a meeting. And basically the United States and Canada were pushed off to the side. It's like, you're not going to run us anymore. You're not going to run our business anymore. Goodbye. So the United States is a big ship with all of its lifelines being cut. See there where that goes. But as I said, this started out by an article saying that 39% of family wealth in the last 3 years was lost. I don't know. I don't know where this is going, but it's a train wreck that, as I said, the United States now, the next election has already solidified. You're going to get either Romney or Obama, and they're going to be the same. And you better put on your seatbelt as soon as this election solidifies, because things are going to get really bad then. Just a quick mention on products. I have not mentioned any of my products in weeks before. I don't have commercials every 3 minutes on my radio show, and I pay for my own airtime. I don't know if a lot of people know that. And the way that I can support that, and by the way, I'm not doing this, mentioning this because I'm hurting or anything like that. If nobody bought anything, I would still be on the air and still bring you this information. But people out there, I have products that are very good products. They're the best ones available. And the water filters, the pre-filter is the only, it's the only place you can get that. It fits on any of the standard water filters in the industry, and it allows you to pre-filter sludgy water, oil-filled water, water that might have dust and radiation pollution. Get that out of there before you put it into your water filter in case of an emergency. And actually, there are people that are using that every day in their house because they have such poor water. And they would clog up their water filter by, you know, the minerals in the water. So they use the pre-filter actually every day. There's some people using that. And then all my books, and CDs and DVDs, information, the posters, and then, of course, the name-branded water filters. I still sell the Dalton water filters. Those are still available. They cost more. But some people buy them. They just, you know, there's something to name recognition. But a lot of people have were very happy when I was able to name brand. And so I have my own product line of water filters that save you a lot of money. And they're the same high quality. It's just that they're name branded. And just because of the time I've been in this business, and I've been able to name brand the products and bring you a lot of saving. So at any rate, go to the webpage jmccsci.com and look around and see what's there for you, and make sure you get the books, CDs, etc. That's tremendous information, and that's the basis. Once you understand what's in those books, that's the basis. That's the bottom line. Then you can start building on that, because you'll understand how the world works and how science is controlled. That's one of the biggest things that I talk about on this radio program, the control of science and scientists. The other day I was talking to some people, and we were talking about, they said, well, look at all these PhDs are all in agreement, and they're saying something different than what you say. How do you account for this, that all of these PhDs say the same thing? And I said, well, yeah, that's exactly the point. They wouldn't have gotten their PhD if they didn't say that. They're textbook repeaters. How do you get a PhD? You go to the your professor, you sit in a class, and you repeat what the professor says, you put it down on a piece of paper in a test, you get an A, you're rewarded, you think you're smart, so you go on to the next level. And of course, in science, there's a lot of technical ability, etc., but I'm talking about the major overlying theories. Plate tectonics, the Big Bang, black holes, comets, they say, are dirty snowballs. If you regurgitate this to your professor, and all of your other work and all your equations and everything else seem to add up, and of course, over the years, they've had time to polish their stories, so it's palatable for the public. And the public is generally scientifically ignorant enough. They can't ask a single intelligent question. They don't understand misinformation. So the bottom line is that the public really doesn't have a good yardstick for measuring the validity of science. And so that's what I do on this radio show. I pick it apart piece by piece and show the flaws in it. And once you start to see a flaw here and a flaw there, you go, huh, yeah, this standard science stuff really doesn't make sense. And then you start to open your eyes to other flaws in the system. But if you go way back in history, it's always been very important for the rulers, the people in control, to control technology information, scientific information, and on and on and on. Why? Because an educated public is a dangerous public in terms of the political control. So they've always had a second layer of science, the flat earth. Don't go over that ocean, you're going to fall off the edge. And we have a lot of science like that today. NASA right now just launched a new satellite. It's going to look for X-rays. So the first thing they say is, oh, we're looking for black holes, all of the effects of black holes. Well, there are lots of other things that cause X-rays. But before that satellite ever reaches orbit, the public is being told that we're going to look for the X-rays from black holes. And the public goes, black holes, must mean that there are black holes. No, there are no black holes as far as I can tell. And basically, theoretically, they're impossible to detect. If you see X-rays in the universe, there are many other causes of X-rays. The main other cause is electrical conditions. But Stanford doesn't believe in electrical conditions, so we're not going to talk about that to the public. And the big CNN article where you have experts from Caltech and from Yale and all kinds of high-powered people, that sounds pretty impressive. But like I said, take all your PhD scientists, whether it's geology, evolutionary biology, whether it's physics, whether it's astronomy, and by the way, there's a lot of solid material in physics, but when you get into astrophysics, that's where the break occurs. They're still dealing with a lot of fairy tale science on how things work out there, because, see, you can't get a lot of processes in outer space into your laboratory. So you have to do little pieces, and then you have a guy that sits down with a piece of paper and makes some calculations, and then you have to work it into a framework of overlying physical concepts that supposedly rule the workings of the universe. So that's where the division is. There's a lot of misconceptions that if you have a really good telescope out there, it's giving us good information. Yeah, but then what happens to that information? It's interpreted. It has to be molded into the standard fairy tale science that's pawned off to the public. But you know what? Above that fairy tale science, tier two science that's out there, there's a whole level of science that you never see, you never hear about, and that information only goes up the ladder to the people in control. And that's the way it's always been. The people in control have always harbored the good information and put the flat earth, you're going to sail to the end of the ocean and fall off concept, they've put that off to the public. And so that's what we have today, a lot of flat earth science out there for the general public. Keep them stupid. Don't let them think. And so, at any rate, the thing I do with my books is I give people a basis for the way the universe really works. Electricity is very frequently seen in outer space, but it is not the dominant controlling force. Gravity still is the dominant controlling force. There's got a bunch of wannabe yo-yos running around the internet saying that everything in the world and the universe is caused by electrical effects, and it's really not true. The electrical effects are very subtle. They have to be understood in context. And there again, those groups are supported by NASA. Why would NASA support groups that claim to have Velikovsky or support Velikovsky in electrical concepts in the universe? Why would they get support from NASA? Well, that's because it's goofy science. It's the standard disinformation technique that if you're going to control information, you have to control both sides. You have to control the so-called bad guys and the good guys. And then you can control all the information going to the public. And you got the goofy science on one side and you got the NASA guys on the other. And the public ends up with a real mess. That's all I can say. And so the Mayan calendar, the supposed groups that have made a living off of pretending they support Velikovsky but want you to buy their books, it's a whole collage of misinformation out there, and the average guy in the street just does not have the wherewithal to sort this out and understand the underlying moving, shaking funding of these groups. So at any rate, I'm going to go on to the main science topic now. The Moses earthquake event. Now, here's basically, in a nutshell, the story. Moses goes up to the Mount Sinai to get the tablets. And he had been up there previously, before bringing the Israelites out of Egypt. He had been up to that mountain before, so this was not a new place for him. He had been up there before. And so anyway, he goes back up there, gets the tablets, the Ten Commandments, and comes back down. As he's coming down the mountain, there's an earthquake. And the earth opens up, and a lot of people fall into caverns, etc., as the earth is shaking there. And so once again, if you look at all of the events, the burning bush, the pillar of fire, I talked about that a couple weeks ago, the parting of the Red Sea, which is basically as the earth is jostling, as the large comet Venus, the protoplanet Venus in comet form is coming by in the nucleus, you can see all of these effects happening. These were real events. As I said, they found the chariots of the Pharaoh in the Red Sea, right at that crossing point. They know where it was. It was at that narrow section of the west of the Sinai Peninsula that connects to Egypt. That's where they crossed. We know this. This is very historically well known. They found the chariots there in the ocean a number of years ago, about 20 years ago. There was a big National Geographic spread on it. So at any rate, these events were real in the But like I say, the feel good, everybody's happy, shake the guy's hand next to you. Churches, everybody's supposed to feel touchy feely good. Put your money in the collection box, and that's your hour of service to God this week, and leave. Okay, well they don't teach anything. They don't teach the real stories, and they follow the lead of standard science that nothing happened back there. The most important events that formed who we are today don't get mentioned. But at any rate, what I'm saying is the earthquake event, as Moses came down with the tablets, there was an earthquake. A lot of people were swallowed up into the earth. In other words, the earth opened up, the people fell in, and then this is happening with a major earthquake. Now, today's earthquakes, let's kind of set the stage for this. The earthquakes we see today, let's talk about the major, you know, 6, 7, 8 on the Richter scale earthquakes. These are not the ones I'm talking about. They kind of shake the ground, buildings fall down, things are destroyed, bridges are wrecked, you know, etc. Let's look at the one in Haiti. Haiti had a pretty big earthquake. All the people out in the countryside, you know, the chicken shed fell over, but after propping that up the next day, they were back to normal. Not a big deal. The people in the city, that's what we heard about, because all the people living in the city, all the infrastructure was destroyed. All the buildings were on the ground, so they had no place to go. So what do? They bring in tons of bottled water. Well, that's great. You take your 1 liter bottle of water, now you got an empty plastic container, you throw that into the, you know, that gets washed into the sea, and that ends up littering all of the other islands around the Caribbean that are covered with plastic bottles on their shorelines, literally covered. I have a picture of that on my webpage, on the sales page, a picture of all of the bottles on the shorelines around all around the Caribbean area. But anyway, that's what they did to try and save the people of Haiti. But okay, those were, you know, 6, 7, 8 on the Richter scale, something like that. Let's take a 20, a 25 on the Richter scale. We're talking a planet coming by, a 300 to 400 foot wave, land wave, rolling across the land at 1,000 miles an hour. One that comes in and crashes into the mountain ranges that currently exist, and that energy is expended. We're talking about shaking that is beyond belief. It is so much more devastating. We're talking about the oceans moving around. We're talking about a pole shift that moved the surface of the Earth over the inner core by 35 degrees. This is major league shaking. Okay, when those kinds of things happen, mountain ranges are formed and exaggerated, and of course this has happened many times in the past. If you go to the mountain ranges, and it's something that I do regularly to go study mountains, they're coming in from all directions. The standard science says, oh, it's plate tectonics. The Atlantic Ridge is moving under the Pacific Ridge, and over here the Rocky Mountains are forming slowly, moving up 1 centimeter per year. It's absolute fairy tale science. And that's one of the things, one of my goals is to put the last nails in this concept of plate tectonics. It's so absurd and ridiculous that somehow the cooling Earth, all by itself, these plates start moving around sideways. And continents break apart and form and push together, etc. It's just absolute fairy tale science. If you understand that the Earth has had hundreds, if not thousands, of major encounters with large celestial objects coming through the solar system throughout its history, throughout Earth's history, and so all of the other planets have also. Something like Jupiter is a gas planet, so you're not going to have the major effects of, say, visible Earth, or what would you call it, land damage, because the solid ball in Jupiter is so far down in its atmosphere, we just have no way of seeing it. But Earth, or Mars, for example, Mars has a very has mountain ranges, but they also have areas where the land separates. And I just spent a good deal of time down in the American Southwest looking at the Grand Canyon, Bryce Canyon, the mountain ranges, much older mountain ranges in Zion National Park. And what do you see in that area? Before I talk to the mountain about the mountains in Montana, the mountains in Colorado, the Canadian Rockies, and so now I'm going to talk a little bit about those canyon areas down in the Colorado Plateau, specifically in the area of the Grand Canyon, Bryce Canyon, And these are major league splits in the earth. Well, what's going on? If you have an area of the earth where mountains are building, you have extra land, land in those regions that are smashed together. Well, something has to give. If you have that much land conglomerating in one place, then there have to be other areas where the land literally splits open. And so the thing I want to point out is that you look at the land and it's from the air. You can look at it from the ground, and I'll talk about the different views. Let's take Bryce Canyon. If you look, the land comes up. It's just normal, and all of a sudden, it just wham! It drops down 9,000 feet. That is a big hole in the ground. Where did the land go? There are people that say, well, it was burned out by electrical discharges from comets. Well, that's a nice concept, but the reality is there may have been some scarring, there may have been electrical discharges, but you can see the layers in Bryce Canyon dropping down. And so here is what had to have happened in that region. And this is a basin that runs for about 200 miles. You can see the next mountain chains probably a good 100 miles away. And the basin that is there has simply dropped down. And here's how you can tell this is not something, a fantasy or whatever. It's actually very observable. When you look at the very edge of the canyon, the land is normal. You have kind of minor rolling hills. All of a sudden, you have a drop-off of hundreds and thousands of feet. If you go out a little bit, there are piers and spires. The stratification of the layers is actually dropped down 200 feet. You go out a little farther, then it's like 300 to 500 feet down. And you can see the layers that used to match up with the walls of the canyon are now dropped down 200 or 500 feet. You go out a little farther, and they're dropped down 600 or 700 feet. And then you go down farther, out a little farther. So basically what happened is this land simply dropped. And how could that happen? How can land fall? Okay, well, let's look at a forming planet. That's highly volcanic. This volcanic activity is going on. In this volcanic activity, and I would suggest you look, for example, at make some breakfast cereal on the stove, either oatmeal or one of the wheat cereals that's ground up a little more, or one of the breakfast cereals. Okay, it starts out, you pour your breakfast cereal in boiling water, and then the cereal starts to soak up the water and thicken. And you're left, and these bubbles are coming up. Okay, they'll come up to the surface, and they'll kind of come up very slowly. You'll see the surface building up, and then bloop, it'll kind of explode and then sink back down in, and you're left with a depression in the cereal. And this is what the Earth was like as it was forming, boiling hot lava, stone. Everything was molten, and that allowed the Earth to pull itself into a near sphere shape. All of the big round planets went through this process. And then as the heat and gas bubbles expanded and tried to rise up to the surface, some of them were trapped there. So you're left with a big dome area in the surface of the Earth itself, in the mantle and in the crust. Okay, so now this starts to solidify. There's enough, you're walking across the land in that area, and there's enough support that you're not going to fall down in, but all of a sudden a planet starts coming by, a planet-sized object that's, in the form of a comet, remember. But that the gravitational effect of that coming by Earth is going to shake the Earth. And like I say, you're dealing with a 20, a 25 on the Richter scale earthquake. All of a sudden, this starts to shake, and that land that's in above the bubble starts to move, and whoosh, it drops down in. In the case of Bryce Canyon, it dropped in some points as much as 9,000 feet. And you can see the stratification layers, boom, 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 juxtaposition down as you go out farther into the cavern there. If you read the standard scientific explanation on the posters there that come from our illustrious PhDs in geology, they'll try and tell you that millions and millions and millions of years ago, long before you could ever imagine, there was a plate that started to move up, and that the Colorado Plateau, which covers pretty much the states of Colorado, Wyoming, down through Nevada, Utah, into northern New Mexico and Arizona, that plate, which is literally lifted up by 5,000 feet, that's what people call the high desert, and then the Rocky Mountains over there sit on that just kind of floated up by itself. It floated up. That's what they say. It floated up on a bed of lava. But when you look at the layers, whether it's the Grand Canyon, whether it's the canyons up in Utah, or you keep going north, those layers, many of them were formed deep under the ocean or deep under lake beds. So this land went down, and then it went up, and it went into down under the water again, and then up again. And this, you know, they just gloss over this like millions of years ago, in a land far away, in a place that you shouldn't really think about too much, all of these things happen. And the people read it and take pictures, and it's an amazing sight. But nobody really questions the real scientific basis for the explanations, the standard explanations for what happened there. And it's just fairy tale science. It could not possibly be true. And then how does the Earth just all of a sudden decide to form a fault line and start moving one plate up over here and another plate just dropping down? Fairy tale science, there's no explanation. The other thing is when you look at the mountain ranges that surround all of these areas, southern Utah, northern Arizona, here's another type of mountain range that you see. Let's look at the LA Basin. To the north of Los Angeles is a series of immense mountains. These are big, serious mountains, and they just come right up out of the ground. You come up to the edge of them, and boom, there they are. There, you're coming on a flat grade, and all of a sudden, the mountains are there. And you see a lot of this in the American Southwest. If you want to see some pictures, aerial pictures, real good aerial pictures, get my CD, 110 Pictures of the American Southwest, Aerial Photography from 40,000 feet, and you'll see what I'm talking about. You'll see mountaintops, basically, and then just a plain of like sand and gravel, etc. And you go, well, how did this happen? Well, what happened is the mountains had formed long before, and then there was a seabed there. Because during the epochs of large comets coming by with their big nuclei, planet-sized nuclei, and the gravitational wave, these areas were plunged under the ocean and lifted up as the Earth was contorted into different shapes, basically along the surface. And so the point is that these areas dropped under the ocean, were raised above, they were compressed, and also the mountain ranges formed coming from many different directions, depending on what the direction was of the passing heavy massive object at that time. So the basins, in the LA basins, for example, that when the ocean was there, that was filled in by erosion from the mountains, etc., the mountains breaking down and washing into that basin. That gives you the nice flat basin that connects these mountain ridges. But down below that sand, those mountain ranges continue down to where they used to be. So that's the formative process. And, of course, the Earth had many, many, I would say probably thousands of these mountain building episodes, at least 100 major episodes that you can see. And then I would say there were 20 what I would call real major episodes of mountain building, where you'll see up in the very upper Rocky Mountains, you'll see layers that were built under the ocean. You know, at 14,000 feet up in the Rocky Mountains, you're seeing layers that were created under the ocean. And on top of that, layers that were created, say, on a lake bed later in the... And then all of a sudden, all of this is upthrust. Geologists agree that the Rocky Mountains are fairly young. You know, maybe a million years old. Well, where did that come from? Well, you know, the fairy tale science, if you look at it, it can't explain. Let me get down to a little more detail. Let's look at a mountain range. You see waves of them across the land. They're all thrust up in the same direction with the layers of Earth, the stratification layers of Earth, breaking apart this big section of land, just thrust up almost on its side. And then over a little farther, what do you see? One that comes up in the other direction. Well, if you talk about plate tectonics, the concept of plate tectonics, where the oceans are, the land under the oceans in the middle of the ocean are splitting apart and drifting, then you should have one big long layer of mountains, and they should look like the same system of mountains. And that's not what you see. When you get right down to the mountain ranges, they're coming from all directions, the north, east, south, and west. And they're coming at different epochs. You can see they're very different ages. The earth, that the layers of earth that are exposed in these upthrusts were built, you know, millions and hundreds of millions of years possibly earlier. And when you look at this, I want to make a proposal here. Standard science says that the earth is 4.5 billion years old. And they determine this by looking at rocks on the surface. What if, and I'm just going to throw this out, what if the Earth is 200 billion years old? And I'm not, that's a possibility. That this planet has been here and it was much smaller at one point. I've got a question for you. When you see all of these stratification layers that are exposed in these upthrust mountains, okay, this building up of land and of land material is going on over, you know, what do they say, sometimes a million years per inch in certain areas. That's how long it took to build up. Or hundreds of thousands of years if it was per inch if it was in a lake area that was more active or in a seabed area that was more active. But, okay, this is happening all over the world. Where is this material coming from? The concept that I always had when I was a kid was that, oh, well, the material came from over here and somehow got to this other place in the world over here. Well, then you start thinking, but wait a minute. Then there should be a big hole over here when there's a big mountain over here or land building over here, layering over this part of the earth. Where does all this dirt come from? Well, the answer to that is that, once again, this doesn't come from Earth itself. There's a constant influx of material from outer space because Earth is a comet. We have a comet tail. We have water coming in from that comet tail. And it's constant. It's constantly building up. How does the water, people have asked me this, one time I was in a conference and talking about the hydrological cycle of Earth. How does the water, what happens to it? Wouldn't the lake levels be rising fast and the ocean levels be rising fast because of this influx of water? And here's the answer. When the water comes into the atmosphere from outside, it cycles into our normal hydrological cycle. And that is kind of an effect where it evaporates, it goes up and it rains and it falls down. But as this process of evaporation rain continues, that water slowly cycles in a pattern going northwards in the northern hemisphere and southwards in the southern hemisphere, and eventually ends up at the poles where it builds up and never leaves. And so, of course, now the poles are starting to melt because we're coming out of the last ice age. But the point is that the majority of that water that comes into our atmosphere does not add, it very quickly cycles up to the poles where it is dumped and left permanently. So but the influx of dirt that comes in is dust, minerals, whatever you want to call them, that are constantly coming in from outer space, build up very slowly all over the Earth. So the Earth has been building and building. It could not possibly be true that the Sun is, when they talk about the heat engine of the Sun, I had a real interesting event happen. I was at a scientific conference. A guy came up to me and he said, "Look, I'm an engineer. I'm an amateur astronomer, etc." But he says, "I posed this problem to the scientific community and nobody will answer. If you take the proton delivery in the solar wind and you calculate the daily mass loss of the Sun due to simply the solar wind, then you calculate the energy loss, the conversion of matter into light energy, and then we know what the general output of the Sun is in terms of light energy across the spectrum, from the microwave infrared up to the very high energy light that comes off the Sun. We know pretty much what that is. That comes from the conversion of matter, E equals mc squared. So then let's calculate the mass loss due to the light coming off the Sun. So you have two mass loss components, and of course there are electrons coming off the Sun, which is a minor component. If you calculate that, the Sun, with its current mass, could not possibly last 4.5 billion years. It wouldn't last a third of that. It would be all gone. So how on earth did the Sun last for that long? And of course, standard science doesn't want to talk about that. That's the bury their head in the sand technique. So at any rate, the point is that Earth could be very much older. The Sun has to have a renewable source of hydrogen, which keeps that engine moving, burning. So this whole solar system could be much, much older, including planet Earth, than standard science wants to talk about. At any rate, I'm out of time here. Just remember to go to the webpage and look at some of the products there. I'll be talking again next week about the Moses event, the earthquake. All of the discussion tonight was to tell you that basically these events were real. When you look at Bryce Canyon, compare it to the Moses event, where literally the earth opened up and a lot of matter dropped in there. These are real stories. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.